I opened our worship this morning, dear friends, with the scripture from John's Gospel, the section whereby Jesus has been, he's encountered a group of people, and that encounter was pretty kinetic, we would say in army terms. The people were really angry with him because he'd mentioned Abraham. And then Jesus said, as you heard, before Abraham was, I am. If I may invite you to think of a building, it can be any building you like, that's really important to you, something that speaks to you, a place that, in your own mind, it doesn't take long for you to go back there. I'm going to tell you about a building, an experience of mine, but that's my experience. It's not any better or worse than yours. I invite you to think of a place that is special to you. A couple of years ago, I was really fortunate. The army does, you know, it puts some pretty not pleasant experiences your way, but it also puts some pretty pleasant experiences your way. And I was invited, along with a group of people, to go into London to visit Westminster Abbey. Never been there before, and it was an invitation that I didn't want to turn down. And thank goodness I didn't. We went into London, and this is just me speaking, I can take or leave London. It's not the, I know it's the epicenter of the world for some people, that's fine. It's not for me. If I go into London, it is for a specific reason. I get in, I do what I need to do, and I'm back out of there. That's just me. But this particular day was a similar thing. We were going with a specific intent of visiting Westminster Abbey. And there was a tour organised. We went, and my goodness, the awe of the place, the history contained within. But not just the history, the life contained within. When we were being shown round, obviously it wasn't exclusive to us. There was lots of other people there. The hustle and bustle of life was ever present. And I was delighted with this, even during the tours that were going round, everything stopped for a moment, and one of the clergy got up and said a prayer, and they do that periodically throughout the day. So, is Westminster Abbey a historical building? Yes, it is, but it's also a living place as well. I loved it, and one day I do hope to go back. So that's the building that's in my mind. I'm sure you will have a building. It might be the home you grew up in. It might be your old school. It could be anywhere. It doesn't matter. Part of this tour, though, in Westminster Abbey, the guide told us that, and I'm slightly embarrassed here, I can't remember the date. It wasn't yesterday. When the Benedictine monks arrived there, it was just fields. And they made that their home, and they did what Benedictine monks do. They started to cultivate the land, and then they built a place of worship, a place for them to stay, obviously. And over the years, it grew and grew and grew into what we now look at as Westminster Abbey. And why, I don't know, but that's stuck in my mind. That there was a time, fixed in history, when you could have walked past what we call Westminster Abbey now, and all you would have seen was field. I've nothing against fields. Fields are lovely. But that's quite interesting, isn't it, that literally in time, there was a time when there was nothing but fields, and now, obviously, there's the Abbey, but you know, it's not just the Abbey. You've got the busyness, the life, the hustle and bustle of the centre of London there. And now that's fixed in time. Now, I genuinely hope that 1,000 years from now, 2,000 years from now, Westminster Abbey is still there and still doing what it does. I pray that for every Abbey, not just Westminster, every cathedral, every parish church, every centre of worship. Why? Because in them it's a repository of history and life. Think of the tiniest parish church you've ever seen. It might seat 30 or 40 at a push, and yet you go in and there's stained glass windows, perhaps, there's plaques on the wall, perhaps, there's documents, there's pews where people have sat and sit still. It doesn't matter the awesomeness of the building that we're thinking about. What matters is the fact that it's there, and that they contain within them both history and life. And before they were there, there was something. I can't deny that both of our readings this morning are pretty deep and complicated. Maybe more complex than complicated. There's a part in the Genesis reading that we heard that I think most of us will be pretty familiar with. And for good reason. God takes Abram, as he was then, because his name hadn't changed, he takes Abram out and the stars of the sky are presented to him. And the promise of that vision. That God hears the fact that, yes, Abram, I hear what you're saying. You're an old man now and you don't have heirs. You get that, I get that, but what I'm telling you is everything you see and more, that's going to be the equivalent. Your heirs are going to outnumber this. And it's startling, and it's encouraging, and it's all that good stuff. That promise of a vision, I think we're all familiar with that. But it's also a strange passage, which is why we had read for us a little bit further than just the stars of the cosmos. Abram is directed to get these animals together, the heifers, the turtle doves, etc., etc., sacrifice them, and they're there. Now, when I read that the first time, a long time ago, it didn't make much sense to me. It is, though, or it was, not an uncommon thing. When a covenant was entered into, not just with God, but if there was a big promise to be made, a contractual agreement of some kind, it wasn't uncommon for a thing like this to take place, whereby a animal would be sacrificed and then both parties would walk through the gap. And as you can imagine, this would be quite a sight. It would have been witnessed. So it was quite a good way to put a contract together. People would see, people would remember, because let's face it, this wasn't happening all the time. People would remember, when you said you would do X, Y, Z, and he or she said they would do X, Y, Z, we do remember it because, well, the animals were split in half, and then you walk through the middle of them. You're not going to forget that. So it's quite a good way in the ancient Near East to establish a covenant. A covenant that required responsibility on both sides, that's what covenant is, and a covenant that would be remembered. So that I fully accept the fact that there is a strangeness to our Western ears to hear about what Abram did, but within the context of that culture, it wasn't as odd as it sounds. But when we read on, there is the noticeable addition that Abram falls asleep, and when he wakes up, the fiery pillar, the image of God that would have been known at that time, that it's only God that passes through. Abram doesn't pass through it. You see, he witnesses it, he sees it, but he doesn't pass through. It's a lesson for us that in this covenantal passage, God himself takes an active role. But I wanted to stress that there's something key here that Abram does do. He's not completely passive in this, yes, rather odd passage. When he gets the animals together and does the sacrifice and does the separation of them, other animals come to try and get at them. Now, you can understand in the natural world that's going to happen. But Abram stays awake long enough to keep them away, to chase them away. And I wonder if that is for us in these times. We're not talking about thousands of years ago, we're talking about now, we're talking about March 2025. That covenant, that promises, that assurances, that guarantees are something that need to be protected, nurtured and maintained. It's not a done once and walk away. You will all have heard the great anecdote of the old husband, and the wife says to the husband, "You never tell me you love me." He said, "Well, I told you when we got married 30 years ago. And I meant it then and I mean it now." Well, he probably does, the poor fella. He probably does. But it wouldn't do, gentlemen, I'm speaking to you now, it wouldn't do you any harm every now and again to drop into conversation that you still love your wife. Or when you talk to your kids, or when you talk to your friends, whoever's important in your life, to maintain, to sustain the relationships that we have. Can sometimes come at a price, and I'm the world's worst for this. When you say you're going to do something, and then it gets to like 10 o'clock at night, and you think, "I've not done that thing." And you think, well, you know, you get like the Ur-Willy cartoons where you've got the devil and the angel on either side of the shoulder. Just forget about it, Neil, just forget about it. Of course I could just forget about it. But actually, it's better to say, well, look, if I said I'm going to do this thing, I need to do it. It sounds like nothing very much important. But the older I get and the more I meander and navigate through life, I find actually it's the little things that are the big things. Big things come and go, but the little things are the big things. And as we're reflecting on this, of course we hear about the vultures that come down. We can read so much into that. What is the writer of Genesis trying? Is it a forecasting? Is it just being realistic? Saying, look, this covenant's important, but guess what? Vultures will come. Literal and metaphorical. And you need to be prepared to protect that which is important to you. So our Genesis reading is a massively rich and I think relevant passage for us as we are in our Lenten journey towards Jerusalem, towards the celebration that is Easter. Which of course brings in our Luke reading. Because Jesus, we know, is on his way to Jerusalem at his through his choice. He knows that's where he wants to go. We've had, I think, two Sundays ago, the transfiguration. And as I said then, that's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning. From the transfiguration onwards, Jesus has only one destination in mind, which is Jerusalem. But did you notice in our reading this morning, Jesus is urged to go to Jerusalem by the Pharisees of all people. The very people Jesus kept his vitriol, his harshest criticism for. The Pharisees come to him and say, "Oh, yeah, Jesus, you need to get to Jerusalem because Herod's going to come and kill you. We're being so good and so helpful here. We've got your best interests at heart." They have no best interests at heart. They wanted him to go to Jerusalem because they knew that if he kept doing what he was doing, he was only going to end up one way. They were quite content with that, not knowing the larger picture. And then we get, and I don't know if you picked this up, it's difficult in our translations. We get Jesus at his most caustic and most human. They say, you need to get to Jerusalem or Herod will come and kill you. And Jesus says, you tell that fox. And that surprised me. So I went and did my digging around in the commentaries. Apparently, the word that Jesus uses is the feminine form of fox. I suppose we have that in English as well. But Jesus basically says, you tell that she-fox. And it's a real caustic insult. Now, those of us who've read through our scriptures, we know Jesus has got no problem with women, with females. It's not femininity he's got an issue with. It's just a real off-the-tongue caustic remark to Herod. It's almost like he's saying to the Pharisees, why should I care what this person, you think he's going to, what power does he have over me? He's the king of the Jews, the king's responsibility to protect, to maintain and sustain his people. And yet he's in receipt of Roman money. They'll keep him, he'll happily let the Romans do whatever they want as long as he can keep his loose grip on whatever control he thinks he has. I've got no respect for him. You go and tell him, and I'll go to Jerusalem when I'm good and ready. It's a remarkable insight into the dynamics of the culture and of the pressures and strains that Jesus' ministry brought, but also of the resolve that Jesus had in knowing not only where he was going to go, but what he was going to do. Some of you will still be thinking of that building that's important to you. I hope you are. Please, when we go and have coffee, tell us what that building is and why it's important to you. But like Westminster Abbey, before that building would have been fields, or would have been something. You know, you can take that example. And then for that moment in time, there was something that was important and relevant to you. You know, the Bible has many beginnings. Where does the Bible begin? Genesis 1:1, okay, you ain't getting any prizes for that. There's lots of different beginnings. And this is one. When the covenant between Abram and God is established. But that's true of us too. Our life has many beginnings. Mine was the 10th of October 1979 in Simpson's Maternity Ward. If you said that, you'd be right. But you wouldn't be completely right, because my life has begun over and over again. Sometimes for really good reasons, and sometimes when I've had to think, whoa, put the brakes on. Let's stop. Let's start again. Because God is a God of new beginnings. And that's why I wanted to impress Jesus' own words at the very outset. Before Abraham was, I am. Abram was important. Whatever you're thinking of, that building, that place, maybe an event, is important. But as we go on and as we leave that place, we know that everything, however special, will pass to dust. But before Abraham was, Jesus says, I am. He is the beginning and the end and the author of our faith, who takes us from our beginnings, through our life, onto greater things Abraham couldn't imagine the stars in the sky. You and I dare say, could scarce comprehend the blessings that God has for us. But I do hope that for each of us here, for you and for me, we can comprehend even a little of the promises that God has for us, so that our life is enriched, enlivened, and we can leave here knowing that we walk with the living God. Amen.